This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This summit is important for Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe is participating. First of all, Zimbabwe is looking for investors in the energy sector, but also has something to contribute in terms of how to work with investors.
That's Mthuli Nkubi, Finance Minister of Zimbabwe, talking about how the Powering Africa Summit being held in Washington, D.C. is important to his country. Details coming up. Also, in Sudan, UNICEF says armed men are raping and sexually assaulting children. And the World Health Organization reports cases of cholera and acute watery diarrhea across 19 countries in January. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. United States government officials, African ministers, institutional investors, private financiers, and service and technology providers have gathered in Washington, D.C. for the 10th annual Powering Africa Summit. With the goal of continued investment in energy transition, the summit has a new theme, the future of the U.S. and Africa Energy Partnership. VOA's Anthony Labruto is in downtown Washington, D.C., covering the event. He talked to me a short while ago on what was going on.
Day two of the Powering Africa Summit here in downtown Washington, D.C. There was a little bit of a mix-up as the first day and the second day, but originally the opening keynote speaker was going to be the recently confirmed U.S. Secretary of Energy. They ended up substituting that now for today and really now centering around today, around the U.S. Secretary of Energy. He just recently spoke. And he's now going into sort of a conference with some of the energy ministers now.
And what was the gist of his speech? Capitalize it for us.
So he described really the future of U.S.-Africa relations, the future of U.S.-Africa energy partnership, really, which is the theme of the summit this year. He called it unapologetically ambitious. He mentioned America first, but the partners where America leads with strength, but now the African continent can lead with power. You know, a lot of them mentioning yesterday that they're both the United States and these African energy ministers were really looking to redefine the future of U.S.-Africa energy partnership, really. And they want, in particular, more of a mutual respect. And that's something that we really heard from Secretary Wright today, that he is looking to view African energy leaders, view African companies as really equals with the United States, that they can bring something to the table. The United States can bring something to the table, and it can be mutually beneficial for the both of them.
And who are the luminaries from Africa that you had an opportunity to actually observe or hear?
So we had the opportunity here, the VOA Africa team, to listen in on the Vice President of Liberia give an opening speech. Energy ministers from Sierra Leone, Egypt, Morocco, Somalia, really across the continent, both energy ministers, but also mines ministers and infrastructure ministers, too. It was interesting to see really the variety that African delegations have sent, not only within kind of the power generating sector, but also within that raw resource and that refinement sector as well.
So what do the participants actually plan to take away from this summit?
Particularly the African delegations that have come really were looking to see how the Trump administration would be reacting really within this new diplomatic sphere, really. You know, what were they going to be walking into? And really, it seems like they're kind of walking away happy that they've heard Secretary Wright's word, they've heard a lot of American companies speaking out, that they're really looking to redefine from past administration how they want to go forward with future investment endeavors, future power generation endeavors, and really seeing a key kind of mutual respect that they said they really hadn't seen necessarily in previous administrations.
So is this the last day of the summit?
Yes, this is. Yes, this will be the closing out of the summit, although a couple of different ministers I'd spoken to said they'll be around, probably speaking with Secretary Wright, different U.S. officials to maybe hammer out some more concrete things, but this will be the end of the official summit, yes.
That was VOA's Anthony Labruto covering the last day of the Powering Africa Summit in Washington, D.C. So, at this summit, one of the participants was Mthuli Ncube, Finance Minister of Zimbabwe, and he was asked by Taboka Ncube of VOA's Zimbabwe service why the summit is important for his country.
This summit is important for Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe is participating. First of all, Zimbabwe is looking for investors in the energy sector, but also as something to contribute in terms of how to work with investors. But also we've come to learn from others as to how we can attract various investors into our various projects. As you know, we've got an array of opportunities in the energy sector. We have abundance in of coal, for example. So in terms of thermal power, we need more investors. That's a resource that we have over 200 years in terms of a deposit of coal. But also we have abundant opportunities in the renewable energy space. And again, we're keen to grow this renewable energy space, get more investors, so that we can diversify our energy sources. But also there are countries in our region that are producing excess power. Let's say Angola, for example. Again, working in partnership with other countries, we want to see how this power can then be evacuated into areas of deficit. As you know, in the last year, we're in an area of deficit, for example, because of low water levels in Caribbean, our hydropower is under pressure. So all of that requires us to engage globally. That's why we're here at this US-Africa Summit, to make sure that we can pitch to investors.
That was Mthuli Ncube, Finance Minister of Zimbabwe, on why the Powering Africa Summit is important for Zimbabwe. The United Nations World Food Programme continues to warn of food shortages across southern Africa, with good rains arriving too late for farmers to plant crops. In 2024, crops failed and thousands of livestock died because of the region's most devastating drought in 30 years, intensified by the El Niño weather pattern. Darren Taylor reports.
Maize is southern Africa's most important food crop, but all the region's major producers of the grain have been hit by drought. In Zimbabwe, maize production is down by 60%. Zambia's harvest was cut in half, and Malawi and Mozambique also suffered big losses. South African agricultural economist Wandile Sihlobo says his country has weathered the drought better than others because of his high-tech commercial maize farming sector. But it too has been impacted, he says, with its usual annual maize yield of 13 to 15 million tons, dropping by almost a quarter, a decrease that affects the entire region and beyond.
South Africa is the world leading exporter in white maize. That's how important white maize is. On stable grains, we are a net exporter, particularly on maize. But the season that we just finished was very tough. We had that midsummer drought that led to our harvest declining by 23%. So stocks are a bit tight, and our neighboring countries, the likes of Zambia, Botswana, and the others, are faced in even much tougher problems, and they are buying a lot more even from us.
But South Africa needs its own grain stocks to feed people during the coming winter. Sihlobo says it can't afford to sell as much as it usually does to the rest of the continent, even as demand for its maize from other countries continues to spike.
We've seen that outside demand pushing up the South African prices. If then the prices remain at the levels that we are seeing now, just over 6,000 rand per ton for a sustained period, it does mean that in the next few months, we may see that grain-related food products remain at a slightly elevated period. But there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because we are starting now a new season. And by all indications, the farmers suggest that they will plant more area, and we are beginning to see some good rains in some regions in the northern parts of the country. This is all to say the problem we are having now of tighter supplies is short-term.
But the rains haven't fallen in time for subsistence farmers, who normally account for most maize production to South Africa's north. Sihlobo says there's a high possibility of crop failures at a time when good harvests are desperately needed to cover for the disastrous 2024 season. Hungry people across much of the region, including in Madagascar, Malawi, Mozambique, Zambia, and Tanzania, have been left waiting for rain. The World Food Programme late last year reported that more than 27 million people in southern Africa won't have enough to eat in the coming months, the lean season between harvests. UN agencies have begun expanding some operations in the region this year to respond to the challenge. The regional nutrition manager at the United Nations Children's Fund, Gilbert Chitaudi, says many children across southern Africa are malnourished.
We have seen the rates of malnutrition increasing. Children are really not getting adequate food. Stunting has been very pervasive. In fact, in the past 25 years, we've not really been able to reduce the level of stunting. So which means that, these children are condemned because it affects their development, it affects their learning capacity, and it also affects their mental capacity, which of course will also affect their educational status.
Even in times of plenty, says the Global Nutrition Report, thousands of children in southern Africa die of hunger, often because their caregivers simply cannot afford food. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, warns that life-saving food and nutrition assistance in the central Sahel and Nigeria will halt next month without urgent funding. In April, funding shortfalls will force WFP to suspend aid for 2 million crisis-affected people, including Sudanese refugees in Chad, Malian refugees in Mauritania, internally displaced persons, and vulnerable food-insecure families in Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and Nigeria. The UN Food Agency is seeking $620 million in funding to ensure continued support across the Sahel and in Nigeria over the next 6 months. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. In Sudan, UNICEF says armed men are raping and sexually assaulting children, including infants, as young as one, amid the nationwide conflict rippling across the country. UNICEF spokesperson Joseph English tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that data compiled by gender-based violence service providers in Sudan paint a horrific picture of the sexual violence children are suffering in North Darfur and elsewhere around the country.
The stories that we heard from women and children really shone a light on something that receives far too little attention. As we've seen, almost 2 years since the escalation in Sudan, the conflict and the wider humanitarian crisis has created an urgent protection crisis for children. And as you say, with reports of rape and horrific sexual violence, it's infants, children as young as one. We recorded 221 cases of child rape last year, so in 2024. But as we know, with sexual violence in conflict and sexual violence in fragile settings, this is likely just a fraction of the true scale due to the fear and the stigma and the lack of access to services for survivors.
Tell me where this is happening exactly. Is this mostly in El Fasher, these incidents of rape?
So this is really an issue that we see across all parts of the country. Certainly, we know that it is a very real threat to children and to women in those areas where fighting is fiercest, but also that is often the places where people have least access to the critical services in terms of support. We also see this even in areas where, you know, the fighting may not have been as severe, because the wider situation of the conflict just makes people more vulnerable. You know, when people are displaced by fighting, when they're living in displacement camps, even if they are not directly affected by by the fighting and the conflict, it raises the risk of gender-based violence, including, you know, sexual violence, including early marriage, and including all of these kind of threats to women and girls.
Is this sexual violence forcing women and girls, and even boys, I guess boys are being raped too, is it forcing women and children to leave their homes?
It is, yes. We certainly see not even always the direct threat of violence, but the pervasive sense of fear can really be a driver for women and girls, especially, but as you say, also for boys, because our study, you know, the reports that we found that boys made up a third of the victims of the reports of violence. And so it is a very real threat. You know, we continue to see that when people do not feel safe in their home, they are forced to make impossible decisions about leaving and about, you know, going in search of safety, whether that's in displacement camps, whether that's crossing borders to become refugees. So this is certainly one of the factors that is behind people's thinking when they do leave their homes.
I know that UNICEF is still there in many places in Sudan, even though it's dangerous. So what is UNICEF doing to try to help these survivors?
We are, you know, everywhere where we have access, we're working with our partner organizations. And I think it's important to really, you know, highlight the incredible work that local organizations, Sudanese people are doing, establishing safe spaces, integrating gender-based violence services into health clinics, meeting people where they are, and then obviously also providing that medical care and mental health support, because, you know, these kind of attacks have long-term impacts for the survivors. And it's really important that it is not just, you know, immediate care and support that's provided, but long-term. You know, but that's reliant on funding, and that is reliant on our ability to access communities where they are.
UNICEF spokesperson Joseph English, he was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from New York. A United Nations helicopter was attacked in South Sudan while attempting to rescue members of the National Armed Forces today, resulting in the death of a crew member. The United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, said a South Sudanese army general and other soldiers also were killed in the attack in Nasir, Upper Nile State. The government forces have clashed with the White Army militia there for several days. The UN team was attempting to extract the armed forces from the area. The head of UNMISS, Nicholas Haysom, called the attack utterly abhorrent and said it could be a war crime. South Sudan ended a 5-year civil war in 2018 with a power-sharing agreement between bitter rivals, President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar. But tensions have been flaring in South Sudan's Upper Nile State, where the government says its army is fighting rebels supported by forces loyal to Machar. Over the past week, the government has arrested senior officials linked to Machar, threatening the peace agreement. The World Health Organization has reported over 34,700 new cases of cholera and acute watery diarrhea across 19 countries in January. The African region registered the highest number of cases, followed by the Eastern Mediterranean and Southeast Asia. Cholera spreads through contaminated water, causing severe acute watery diarrhea that can be fatal within hours if untreated. Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer for the WHO Africa region, tells VOA's Lenore de Moudou several factors are contributing to the multi-country cholera outbreak in Africa, including conflict, climate change, and poverty.
Cholera, as we say, is a disease of lack. It happens in a context where we have the population doesn't have access to clean water, there are inadequate sanitation facilities, and therefore it thrives in that context. And there are a number of challenges within our region that have been contributing to more or less continuous outbreaks we have had since 2021 within the region. The number one are development issues. As we know, access to water and sanitation is a development issue. The second one is the climate. We have seen adverse climatic events. We have seen droughts in the Greater Horn of Africa. But we have also seen cyclones and flooding in the southern parts of Africa. The other issue that is very critical is conflict and displacement. Currently, we have a number of conflicts that are active within the region. And we have seen a number of, you know, when people are displaced, they no longer have access to safe water and sanitation, and therefore cholera thrives in that context.
What are the key gaps in treatment and response that need urgent attention?
We always say as WHO that in this day and age, nobody should be dying from cholera. And that's why we've set a benchmark that in every cholera outbreak, less than 1% of the cases should die. And what is the magic bullet for cholera? It is the rehydration. So ensuring that the person, the fluids that they are losing, you are able to replace it. So the number one issue is the issue of lack of access, immediate access to the rehydration, to the treatment. You need a high amount of oral rehydration solution as well as intravenous fluids. And those intravenous fluids, you need to have them closer to where the populations are so that they can be able to use them. And of course, the clinical expertise.
Cholera vaccine is utilized to prevent cholera. Production has increased to 6.2 million doses, according to report. Yet the demand still outpaces the supplies. What strategy is WHO considering to further boost production?
So the issue that we've had with oral cholera vaccines, which are a very good tool for prevention and control of cholera, has been that we only, as of this year, we still have one manufacturer in Korea that's making the vaccine. So, and there is limited capacity that they can produce in a month. And as you have rightly mentioned, we have a high number of countries that are having outbreaks. So the doses, every time the doses are being produced, they are being shipped out. So we don't even have a stockpile. So the immediate action that was taken initially was to suspend the two-dose strategy so that now we only use one-dose strategy, so that at least we can spread the doses thin and ensure that the communities that need them are able to receive. But there has been ongoing engagement with manufacturers to be able to boost production. But as a region, we have also been advocating that we need to have manufacturing of oral cholera vaccine within the region, because we are one of the regions that's mostly affected. And we were excited when BioVac in South Africa did announce that they are making investments to be able to enable them to produce the vaccines.
How effective is a one-dose vaccination?
So there have been a number of studies that have been done, and they show that the one-dose strategy is effective. Because, you know, when you get two doses, it gives you protection of at least 3 to 5 years. When you get the one dose, it gives you protection at least 1 year. So it's ideally supposed to be a measure that buys us time so that we address the water and sanitation issue. But it also helps to reduce the severity of the disease and helps us to interrupt transmission. So it's been a very effective tool once we are able to deploy it effectively early in the response and targeted at the hotspots where there are transmission ongoing.
That was Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer for WHO's Africa region.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week, right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Bill Androdi, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.